Welcome to Wellness Radio with Dr. Jeanette Gallagher as your host. Her show discusses topics of health, wellness, and spirituality and is about discovering your place in this great universe from your cells to the cosmos. Along with her guest, in casual conversation, she strives to ask the difficult questions that may be holding you back from a vibrant life and shares new ideas that may inspire you to make a change in your life that you only can see in your dreams. And now, here is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Wellness Radio. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and it's a pleasure to have you with us here today. Today, we are going to be talking about a topic that is so profound. It has been put into the corners under the bed sheets. It's been medicated down. It's been hidden into circles. It's been taking people out, and it's been holding people back. What are we talking about? Mental illness. Why are we even calling it mental illness these days? We look at, you know, when someone gets cancer, just because our brain or our thoughts or our habits or the way we engage in the world is any different than how our body is working in the world? So what is mental health, mental illness? What happens when things start to go, as we say, awry? And do we need to be medicated down to fit into society? Do we need to be held back and separated out from those we love? Do we need to say those are wrong and shake that wagging finger? And do we need to say we lived a life of mistakes? I don't know about you, but we've said it many times on this radio show before. I have this little list, and it's called Kick These Words to the Curb. And they are fine, suffering, and mistakes. Because you know what? Life is only about experiences, and we need to keep on going. And that's the difference. Because if we live with shame and guilt, with pity, and with all of these things that people put on us, we will never be able to be who we are. And we are strong, we are able to keep going, and we can live and learn, and we can have experiences. Who's to say if they're good or bad? No one's judging me. I don't know about you. Today, my guest is Cortland Pfeiffer. His book is Taking the Mask Off, Destroying the Stigmatic Barriers of Mental Health and Addiction Using a Spiritual Solution. Whoa, big words, but it's everything we've been talking about on this radio show for the last 2 to 3 years. So if you're ready, here we go. Cortland, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Sure. Thanks for having me on the show.
So don't you think, you know, all of those things, you know, what is mental health anymore, right?
Right. I mean, I don't even know how we even and can say something like mental illness. Who are we to say what is ill and what isn't? Sometimes I think the people that walk around and society says that's a healthy person is not. And
right.
And how do we even define that? That word alone is, it's ridiculous to me that we even use that, mental illness.
You know, I think you and I both can understand that it's totally inappropriate to be using these words, because you and I have both had experiences, you know, around different realms of what is health, what is wellness, what is mental health, you know, what's physical health, and all the repercussions all along in generations. And I think that's very important, because when people put a stigma of mental illness on, they are accessing their information from history. They're saying, my grandmother did that, my father did that, my brother did that, my coworker did that. So really, it's a historical legend that they're pulling forward and basing with judgment and labels on a person in front of them, and it, how wrong that is in the first place, right?
Well, you can you have families, this generational pain, we call it, where our grandparents pushed it onto our parents, who we're pushing all this stuff onto each other, and it goes on for generation to generation without even knowing it's happening. And to get to label somebody is it kind of stops us from getting to know the person. It's almost like, mm-hmm. they're bipolar, or they're schizophrenic, and then everything they do is attached to that label. Or if we say somebody has borderline personality disorder, everything they do, we think, if they're being nice, we think, oh, they're manipulating us because that label says they're a manipulator. Or if they're being mean, we say, oh, that's just their disorder. Maybe they're just sad. But when we label somebody, mm-hmm. all of a sudden, everything they do, we try to put everybody in this box. And that's just not how life is. People have ups and downs. And labeling is dangerous, and it happens sometimes because for money. I've worked at offices where somebody can't get services unless they have one of the four major diagnoses. They have to be schizophrenic, major depressive, borderline personality disorder, or bipolar. One of those, there's four of them, and if they didn't meet the criteria, there's no funding for them. And so the doctors would change their diagnosis to get this person funding. They're trying to help. But then this label sticks at the person, and I've seen it over and over and over again. You see the patient for 15 minutes. All you do is they will read the old doctor's chart and say, well, they said this person's schizophrenic. So it's kind of like a cut, copy, paste, copy, paste, copy, paste.
Right.
And nobody ever, once in a while there's somebody who steps in, but not often does somebody just stop and say, hold on, I'm going to get to know this person and look beyond this label and look beyond this behavior. And I'm going to get to know them as a patient and as a person. Instead, it's easier for everybody just to copy what the last person said. But that last person is simply, it's a guessing game, and it's based on their own biases and their own ideas and their own thoughts. And we do this to people, and a lot of these patients just trust the system and trust the doctors. Oh, you're bipolar. That's why you had an up and down mood. I mean, I saw one guy who got mad because he got stuck in a state hospital, and so then he was acting up, and they said, is he bipolar? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, no, he just got his whole life taken from him and put in a state hospital. I think being upset is a normal reaction. But some people, oh, that's bipolar, give him a pill, and it's situational. Or, oh, I broke up with my boyfriend, give him a pill. Now, some of the meds can be effective, but it's way too overprescribed, and this labeling causes stigma, and it prevents us from ever having to get to know each other. Why do I have to get this know to this person? I can just say they're bipolar and read everything about them, and then I never even have to get to know them. It prevents human connection.
Yeah, you know, I think the worst invention, and everybody can beg to disagree or whatever they want with me, but I've been in healthcare since the early 70s. The worst invention was the EMR. Once you put everything in an electronic medical records, it's like golden. You can't get that sucker off of there, for your life depends on it. Just like on the internet, once something gets out there, you know, you're pretty much done. You're going to be labeled like that. And it really prevents a lot of things, you know, going forward. Let's say a person is labeled as bipolar or depressive, and they come into the doctor and they say, you know, I need to give you some medication because you broke your arm or something. Well, they're going to base their medication prescribing upon that other, you know, labeler that's there or whatever. And sometimes they miss those labels, sometimes they catch them. But the point is, there's always these parameters in your electronic medical records when you go to the doctor. Like you said, they don't even get to know the person. They just hit the little drop-down menu, and it says this, and then, you know, up comes the record that says this is what you do. That's what the doctor does in a primary way. It has no longer been individualized medicine. What it's really gotten to be is template medicine, what I call it, because everything is a template. If you have this number, you're in this category, and you do the drop down, you know, and that's just the way it has gotten these days, don't you think?
It is. It is. And I often see the pressure on the doctors from the billing people. You have to see
right.
four patients an hour. You have 15 minutes, 15 minutes, 15 minutes, and you got to get all your charting done. So
yeah.
they'll come in, they'll see the patient, and they'll won't even be looking at them because they're typing, because they have to get that done because they want to get home. And I've seen a couple great doctors who will sit there and take time with their patients and talk to them when they need them. And then I've seen what happens is a supervisor going into this these doctor's office and saying, you need to speed up your production. You need to produce money for the clinic, for the company. And I say, doctors that take time, that's true production. one of the doctors that saved my life, I believe, to this day, I walked into his office, and I had never met him before, and it was kind of a last-ditch attempt, and he knocked on the door, and he said, "Hey, I'm running a little bit late," and just to tell me that. And then I was sitting there, and I thought, that was weird. Then he comes in 30 minutes later, and he sees that, you know, I have depression and anxiety, and I'm very nervous, and I've been afraid to ask for help because doctors before have said, oh, you have tuberculosis or you have a heart condition or
right.
they don't even listen to you almost.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy sat there. He was already behind, and he sat there for an hour with me talking about it. And then he said, we'll give you this med, but I want you to come back in 2 weeks because I want to make sure you're not having side effects. Then I come back 2 weeks, and I just felt so comfortable automatically. And then when I go back in 2 weeks, he knocks on the door, says my name, says, hey, I'm running a little bit. And I said, this guy remembered my name?
Yeah.
And he said, I'll be there. And then he sat there and talked, even though he's an hour behind us. To me, that's true productivity. He saved my life. I mean, he might have not seen four patients that hour. He saw one, but he saved my life. And now I go around telling everybody about him. And I don't come back, and I don't end up back in the hospital. So I say, you know, he saved them more money, and and isn't that what we're supposed to be doing? And if he would have gotten in trouble for taking that hour with me, I mean, what he did with me, I mean, I wouldn't be here today. I wouldn't have done anything. I wouldn't have recovered. I wouldn't have gotten a treatment. And that he wasn't seeing me in 50, and there's so much pressure. See these people, write down their diagnosis, label them. I mean, how often can we meet somebody and put a label on them in 15 minutes and then put it in a chart that's going to stay with them forever?
Mm-hmm.
We don't even get to know people anymore, but he did. And there is people like him out there. There is doctors like there, but he should be the rule, and instead he's the exception.
You know, when I myself as a naturopathic physician, my times with people is generally an hour to 2 hours, you know, when I first meet them. And then an hour, as you know, the time goes on because I don't have those constraints. I don't have the constraints of an insurance system or whatever because it's just not in my paradigm. But when you look at it, people would say to me, well, you know, just tell me what to do. Come on, you know, hurry up. I just need to know what to do because, you know, I'm going to take that pill and I'm going to go good to go tomorrow.
Right.
And I would even say to people, you know, well, you need to take care of their health. And they'll say, no, I hired you to. You know, the doctor takes care of my health. I already have a job. I don't need another job. You know, when you give them four and five different things to do, and it's like, you know, really whose job is it anyway? And then we look at the system of health. What is healthcare system? I think that is the biggest fallacy, and I've written about it before, is that healthcare is not taking care of you. Healthcare is a business. There's a product, and you're the consumer. You're going to go in, you're going to buy it, and you're going to you know, give out your feedback afterwards, or you're going to ask for your money back on your credit card or whatever, you know? It is only a consumer-based business. Healthcare is not taking care of you. Period.
No, it is.
They don't understand that.
No, because we're taught to trust these authority figures. And back in the old days, you go to a doctor, they help you. And this is one of those things that we were talking about, get passed on generationally. My great-grandparents said, you go to the doctor, you get better. It goes to my grandparents. It's a lie that continued. Maybe it started out as the truth, but it became a lie, but it keeps getting passed on. But when was the last time we saw a medication come out that cured anybody? I mean, like we can put a man on the moon, but we can't cure a cold. I mean, they don't come up with medicines. They don't come up with medicines that can cure anybody, because what would happen if people didn't need medicines then? Then the pill companies would make money.
Let's look at history a little bit. When did physicians come about? Physicians came about because they were educated. Pure and simple. Let's take it to what it really is. Physicians were educated people. In other words, they had the money to go to an expensive school to read more books. Now that there's now that there's the internet, everybody is educated. Everybody can read everything in the world. Everybody can, quote, read those books. Are we now saying in the crisis of healthcare, are we saying that a physician knows more than I? Many times they may know more in a guided direction. However, no one knows you more than you yourself. So really, it's best for you to become educated about yourself and your health and how to preserve it, enhance it, nourish it, or have it improve, versus going out and saying, into, as we always say, the 15-minute time, is he going to be the golden rule and, you know, all of that other, and they're just going to, quote, fix you. And I think we look at history, too, don't forget. When our grandparents
right.
were there, you know, grandparents, they only could take care of themselves. Like if the, my grandparents, they worked in the mines, you know. Do you think that they had any thought about anything in health? All they knew about is they didn't get killed that day and they're going to get up for the next day, you know. And now we look at our lives and we almost, I don't think our children can even comprehend that kind of life. You know, they see,
no.
you know, Facebook and social media and Twitter and all this other stuff. And the immediate response, I'm going to drive down the street and I've got 100 choices for food. Where when people, you know, I always remember this. I would say, why did the Polish and Irish always get so focused on potatoes? It's because when there was nothing to eat and people would steal from other people, potatoes were grown underneath the ground. They could hide them. So when potatoes were under the ground, no one knew they had them. They could dig them up and eat them, and they would have food. So it's really a survival mechanism we have to look at in history. But now we don't need to survive. Now we need to learn how to thrive and help others. So there is a huge generational and all of these ancestral hits and changes and transformation in only 100 years. That's incredible.
It is. I think the best for what we know now with all this knowledge out here that people, if they're willing to look at it, you know, some people, you tell them something when they're a kid and they believe it till the day they die. And so if you start to tell them, well, you know, it's okay to question this doctor people, some people still won't do that. And I think the best, whether it's a doctor or a nurse or therapist or whatever you want to call it, the best kind of relationship is a relationship. And you don't treat people based on the disorder. You should treat them based on them. One of the people I learned from, who I think was one of the smartest men I ever knew, people would be on lithium, and they say you have to test their blood levels because the lithium level, when it's toxic, is the same time as when it's healthy. And he never did it. And I went into his office, and I was just curious. And I said, why don't you test the lithium like everybody else on this particular patient?
Right.
And he said, you don't treat based on the DSM and the criteria. You treat based on the patient. Now, she can be more toxic, and it's healthier for her. Her chemistry is different. So I know it's not going to be a problem. And I thought, wow. He was really smart, but he thought outside the box, because most of us are taught, well, you just do what you're told, and if these people say it. And so I think the best kind of relationship, as I was saying, is if it's a relationship, and the practitioner is kind of has a map, and the patient is driving a car, and the practitioner points out things as a guide. Hey, what about this? What about this? But ultimately, the driver is the patient. And it's more like the practitioner is the guide. And it's not like that all the time. So many people say, well, I'm going to my doctor and I trust them without seeing your doctor could be taking money from a drug company. They could have their own personal biases. I mean, look at the opioid crisis, people going to the ER. I bet you I could take a hidden camera and go get Oxycontin right now. I mean, it's not hard to do. I mean, so it's just, we have too much trust, but there's so much people making money off it. I think that's part of the problem. You can't blow up a system that makes people so much money.
Let's look at how mental health has evolved over the generations. I can remember in high school in the late 60s going to many what they would call homes, group homes they would call them. And that would be for teens, the ones that I worked at, teens and young adults who were exhibiting, as they would say, mental thoughts, mental actions, physical actions outside of, quote, the norm. And they would go and they would live in these homes. And I would go in and I would sit there and I would always come home and say, I don't really see anything wrong. I don't really get it, you know. And then along comes, and then along comes Alzheimer's and dementia. Then we did the same thing to adults, you know. Now we look at it and we say, well, now we're going to do with kids with ADD and ADHD and autism and all these other things. And now it has to evolve into, let's talk about the spiritual path that everybody's been on for these last 10 years. And really, is it an awakening? Is it a spiritual awakening? Is it that our minds and our thoughts are evolving? Because if you look at it, you could probably, in essence, go into, if we had those existing in the same timeline now as now, we can go in and say, you know what, we could let all these people go right now because this is the world we're in. We're out there able to speak. We're out there able to be different. We can be an individual. We can feel one thing one minute. We could turn around and feel something the next minute. We can be happy with something. We could feel sad with something. We're able to cry. We're able to wail, whatever that might be. So I think things have really significantly changed in many ways. However, they've even gotten worse in some some systems because we really want to drug them too. You know, I have a really good friend, and he had said that, you know, he was living his life, and he thought everything was hunky-dory, and then he started, you know, feeling depressed. And then, because everybody said he was sad, he went and got the drugs. And then it was time for other medications to come on board. And then one day he says, you know, I was really happy about something, and I was just so excited, and he was bouncing around, and it was something he had wanted to do his whole life. I just couldn't wait, and, you know, I was excited, and I just couldn't stop talking and everything. Well, they took that as, quote, a bipolar break, and they put him in, and they put him in, correct, and then they put his family, put him in for the psych hold, and he got very, and then, of course, now there's more meds. So if we look at mental health, can we say, I'm not saying all mental health issues can be something as a spiritual awakening. However, I think we need to look at spiritual awakening as having some symptoms of mental health changes. And do we want to medicate them? Do we want to put labels on them? Or do we want to say, hey, it's all cool, let's just keep going?
Yeah, well, we need to do something or look at it somehow differently, because the way we look at it now, it doesn't work. I mean, you look at even like an antipsychotic, it will work 20 to 30% of the time. And is it really working, or is it just blocking? And we have this problem with people having feelings and people being outside of the bell curve. And that I don't understand. Now, people who are outside of the bell curve, those are the people that have changed the world in the past. Do you think Gandhi would have fit inside
That's
the box?
Right.
Do you
That's
think
right.
Martin Luther King Jr. would have fit inside the box? Mother Teresa, any of these people that have changed the world, were they inside the box? And what if we had taken today? Now, if somebody came in like that, we would say, whoa, you need to get some help. You want to do what? You want to have black people have the same rights as white people? Sit down, Mr. King. You must be crazy because you're thinking differently.
Yeah,
you're thinking differently than the rest of society.
It's like,
so
don't
now,
do that.
Right, so you can't do that. Well, here, we're going to put a label on you, and we're going to say, you must be depressed, Dr. King. Yeah. Here, take some. So, I mean, that's what we don't allow people to feel. Like, it's okay to be sad. I mean, it's okay to be depressed if something's going on. But if you don't feel the emotion, if you don't bring it to the surface, you can't heal it. And it's okay. And in our society, the way we're like you said, with all the fast food stuff, we're all built on money and doing and consuming and capitalism and all. We're living against human nature. So we're going to have, and there's going to be some people who notice that. Who some people who maybe are more creative and maybe have some kind of gift and maybe see the way that we should live and see that we're not. And so maybe they act a little bit more depressed because they look outside and they see things. They
Absolutely.
Say, look at this. I'm working a 9-to-5 job and I'm sitting in it, and I just come home and I'm wasting my life away, and look at how we're built on making money, and we keep the rich rich and the poor poor, and this is wrong, and so I'm depressed. So that person actually sees the problem, and so we give them a pill and say you're depressed, or maybe that's the kind of person we should be looking to. And now I'm not saying this is the case with every mental health thing, but that kind of is a spiritual awakening. You look at, you're like, what am I watching on TV? What are we doing here? What is the point? Look at how we're living our life. We're taking up all the resources. We're keeping poor people poor. We're taking advantage of people. So somebody who sees that, and somebody who, and then you can even go into schizophrenia when they say, they see or hear things that we don't. Mm-hmm. But studies prove we only use 10% of our brain, okay?
And then they turn around, they look at psychics in the same way, you know, or angel mm-hmm. readers or mediumships or whatever that
right.
is, you know, and they say, well, those things can't be. So you're either on way over and drugged, or you're on the total woo-woo side, but the place they want everybody is in that standard deviation. You just got to be in that middle.
Yep, and then what we're doing by doing that is, we're stopping any kind of progress for humanity because we're taking the people who could change the world and we're putting them in insane asylums. We're putting them in detox centers, or they give up and they start drinking because they can't deal with it. And because there's nothing they can do, or they're on the streets. I mean, but you know what? People benefit off that. I mean, if we keep everybody in this box, then we don't have anybody challenging
the system.
Yeah, and then if nobody challenges the system, we have all these robots, and we can give them all meds and tell them it's good for them, and there's yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir, and that's the complete destruction of everything then, because if we can get these people on the outskirts and either label them as crazy or weird or medicate them, then they go away, and then the whole system can continue to be corrupt.
Correct. And isn't that that is the crux and the beginning of spiritual awakening, in which all people are now starting to understand, you know,
mm-hmm.
I had someone say to me the other day that we really need to learn about personalized nutrition. I said, but how is that going to fit into the world with school lunches? How is that going to fit into the world with hospitals and stuff? Personalized nutrition? No, they're going to give them what they're going to get. And that's the end of the story, you know?
Yep. Yep, it's we don't want individual anything. It's all about system, convenience,
mm-hmm.
money, build, 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 consume, 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 take away from the individual, make us all, and which is mm-hmm. to me is insane.
Yeah.
We have to let people be people.
And it is a tough thing to do because those people that stand up are generally ostracized. They are generally put down. Many different things can happen. And it is kind of, do you keep doing that? And I think some people can keep doing that. Some people do give up.
Well, it's hard.
There are people that can do it in secret too, you know?
Yeah, and what you have is you have people, a lot of these people, I believe, who are on the outskirts of no norm, whatever even normal is, but they're,
mm-hmm.
they think different. And you're right, they're ostracized, they're talked about. And I think what I've seen is the people that are on the outside, as they, mm-hmm. you know, outside of the norm, they're actually the most sensitive, caring people.
Absolutely.
Sensitive people who are extremely sensitive see beauty and see things differently than other people. And so when you're sensitive and then you have the tribe mocking you and you're sensitive already,
mm-hmm.
it's our nature to want to fit into the tribe. So
you're
already
saying,
different.
You know, I'm done. I quit.
Yeah.
You know,
well, right, which
that
is why
white
people,
flag, right?
Yep. Which is why a lot of times you see drinking and substance abuse on people that are on the not inside the normal box, and because they're so sensitive and they know they're different, and then they're talked like that when they do stand up. And once in a while, you see somebody get through it, and then they fight the system, and they don't care what other people, well, they care, but they believe in themselves so much and they love them, their true self so much that they're able, but it's rare.
Yeah.
It's set up that way.
Let's talk about disconnecting from attachments. I think that's really a key thing. When people start to say, you know, I'm so done with that, I'm over that, that is not going to be in my life anymore. I want to touch, feel, sense, and experience my life around me. I'm not interested in that. Sometimes you have to give up your family, friends, your physicians, your paradigms, your job, to be able to say, I need to live a life freer. And I think this is what we're seeing, a great movement of people going to other countries, people going out in the country, and people living, quote, off the grid because they're just finished with that. And they're just, you know, how free can we live and how far can you take, you know, the human experience? And I think many people are starting to see that there are those options.
They are, and that's one of, I think, the hardest things is to do is, I mean, even if you're in a dysfunctional environment, even to leave that, to me, it's like you're on this big bridge and on one side it's cold and dark and rainy and, you know, but you know what to expect. And you jump on the other side, you don't know what's there. And so people would rather stay with the familiar and, leaving your environment is, I think, it's huge. It's if you have to, I think you really do become, you know, they say that you become the average of the five people you spend the most time with. And if we're constantly around people who are criticizing us or abusive or mocking us, and we just want them to accept us and we keep pushing, I think we have to realize people who love us are loving people, and that even really doesn't have anything to do with us. And people who hate us or criticize us, that has to do with them. We have to be around a supportive environment. And you're right, sometimes to actually sit there and realize my family is that, and I have to leave my family.
Right.
And that to leave that environment is extremely difficult because you're going to be lonely for a while and you're going to be sad. And so your tendency is to drift back into that because you don't want to deal with the loneliness because we're taught not to feel that way.
But you know, when you said about being on the other side of that bridge, you know, when you said about it being gray and rainy, and what I always would say, I used to call that the abyss. It was, you felt like you were in a white fog colored room and, you know, there's nothing. It's just the abyss. And many people can take that abyss and feel frightened with it, but I think that abyss is a great time to more or less, you know, as we would say, shake and shimmy and let it go, you know? Let all of that stuff fall off, and the abyss is a great place to be able to take advantage of that, to be able to create who you want to be on that other side.
Yes, yes. That is the beauty of it, is it's blank, and you can make it whatever you want. And you know what? Being alone away from everything and everybody. I mean, a lot of people were in solitary, like Nelson Mandela, and that's how you learn to see who you are, and that's how you learn to grow. But we're so afraid because we're taught you can't be alone, you can't be alone, you can't be alone. Well, if you want to grow, and that's you can, and it's like a blank piece of paper, and what you're doing is you're breaking this cycle of this generational pain, which gets passed on from generation to generation to generation. And a lot of people say it takes five generations to break that. And it takes one person, and usually it's one person. And it's somebody who's extremely sensitive, extremely strong, and who's able to do that. But what they do is they're taking on a lot of pain and a lot of anger and a lot of mock and a lot of ridicule. But what they're doing is changing the legacy of their whole family for generations. The future generations of children who will never know them will benefit from doing that. And it's not just about you. It's about changing the legacy of this, because we keep doing what we're doing. It's just the cycle continues.
And also, too, let's speak for a second about dependency, because when you do get to that point, you will feel that you're independent and you will say, but there's nobody around. And this idea of loneliness, I think it's society that has told us that we have to have a church, we have to have a grocery store, we have to have a movie theater, we have to have friends, we have to have coworkers, we have to have family, we have to have a spouse, because all of those things will make us, quote, complete. Why can we not trust that we are complete as we are already? And then we have no longer need to search. When you have no longer need to search, then you can be happy within yourself. And that is a huge difference.
You
can be loved.
You nailed it. Yep.
Yeah, you can be loved and feel love just in yourself. You don't always need another person. I think we get so wrapped up in that word love. I mean, maybe that needs to be to kick the curb too on that list, because it's not the same thing. It's not romantic love or infatuation or I'm half of a person, you're half a person, and we make a whole kind of idea, you know?
Right.
And it's crazy, you know? And I even looked at, you know, now with the holiday season, Santa Claus has on a red suit and he's drinking a Coke. And they say about loving a Coke. And I'm going, wow, Coke so long ago knew that red, putting red on his suit on the Coke commercial using Santa Claus, would appeal to that quote, that inner love kind of thing, that infatuation love. And it was just so interesting, you know, to see how marketing has shifted, you know, with that, you know. Society just took us down a really rubber hose, you know.
It did. Well, you look. I mean, we can be alone. That's the thing. Is everything's connected already. You already have connection.
Right.
And you look on TV and commercials since the time we're young. You gotta have this house. You gotta have this 4-bedroom house. You gotta have 3 bathrooms or 2 bathrooms. You gotta have 2 cars. You gotta have a spouse, and you gotta have a spouse by the time you're 25, or something's wrong with you. And you gotta have kids. So everybody pressures, and a lot of people make money. Weddings cost money. It creates jobs. And then we have somebody who's 19, 20 years old, 22. Okay, this is the person I'm with. It's who I'm gonna marry. But you change so much from 22 to 35 or whatever. But there's so much pressure to be with this one person. And we're going against nature again, and because we don't have to be married to one person that we've been pressured to be with. So we fit in. And then we look and we say, we wake up one day, if we wake up, and we say, now I've done everything they told me I needed to do, and I'm still unhappy. So what is the problem? And the problem is we're living somebody else's dream. That's that American dream, and it's not real. It's based on making money. It's like that fear and consumption stuff. You're weird if you're alone. You got to get married and you got to buy things. And so we say, okay, I'm going to feel better if I buy stuff and do this stuff. So I do it, and then we don't feel better. And then we're all on antidepressants because we're living against nature. And we can be alone and still be connected with everybody. You still can. We're not we're perfect as we are, and we're told we're not. But that's the genius of these marketing people. That's how you make somebody afraid, and then you get them to buy something. I can say, there might be a snake in your yard. And then the next commercial, buy our fences, and we'll keep the snakes out of your yard. Everybody's like, oh, my God, I'm scared. And I got to be like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
No, you don't. Nobody. We're all different and unique, and we need to be different.
I think sometimes the path to mental wellness is the release of fear, the release of attachments, and the option that you can love yourself and be loved all in one entity, and to trust the world around you. I think those four things are so vitally important, and that's what's called mental wellness. And
that's
is a very tough place for many people to be, because you know, don't forget, when you're in a relationship with someone else, you have someone else you have to, quote, depend on, you have to do something for, they do something for you, their expectations of you, or, you know, in a job, you have the same situation. In a parent and child, you have the same situation. And sometimes just when people get older, I think, you know, we see the elders now. I mean, myself, I'm 60, but we see them, you know, in their 70s, and they're like hippies again. You know, they're out living the world that's free and easy, and like, I don't need any of this stuff. Don't give me a house. I don't want one, you know. I'm going to live in my car, or I'm going to live in a tiny house, or I'm going to live on a boat. Or, hey, maybe I'll go live with one girlfriend for a month, and then I'll go to another one, you know, whatever that might be. But in other words, they just are freeing themselves of that paradigm in which they felt so tied to.
Right, and I think you're right when you say fear and attachment, especially because we are afraid that we're going to be alone. And if people know you're really not ever alone, And I don't think all relationships are. I think if you're in it for the wrong reasons and for society, it can be bad. But if you do have somebody you're truly connected to and helps you grow, it's a wonderful thing. But there's so many people out there that are doing it for the wrong reasons, and we can connect with people in so many different ways. It's just not necessary, and we're doing all this stuff. We're buying all this stuff. We're creating all this fear. If we're not, I mean, I have a daughter who's, 21. I need to have a house. I need to have a car. Everybody else. I'm like, why are you comparing yourself to people, what they put on Facebook? Well, who cares? I mean, you have to love yourself. And because who you are, who your true self is, not the false self, but the true self, that unique person has special gifts that can help humanity and humanity needs. And when we don't love our true selves and we have a false self, we're robbing humanity of who we truly are and those gifts. We're not showing them to the world. And when we do become our true selves, what we do is a million times more, because what we're doing now is like a smidgen compared to what we could do if we really embrace ourselves. But we're almost taught not to. I mean, by parents, by churches, by society, who you are is not okay. You can watch a little boy dancing, and everybody says, that's not okay, that's not okay, and then he gets teased for it. But then if he punches a kid for teasing him, then that's okay. It's okay to be angry, little Tommy, but it's not okay to dance. We train people at the age 2 or 3 years old how they can act.
You know, it's funny. I was giving my dog a bath one day, and she always, I don't know, I had said to her, she was getting ready to shake, and I knew that I had food on the counter, and I was giving her a bath in the kitchen sink. I always do this because I can't bend over. But anyway, I had said to her, I said, oh, good girl. And I just caught myself. I said, wow, good girl. What do you mean? Because she did something that I wanted her to do, so that made her good.
Right.
And I went,
right.
Oh, I'll never say that. You know,
but you caught yourself. Most people don't.
But I never say that, but it rolled out, but it almost rolled out, and then it went right back in. So they said, is that crazy? Are you not crazy? Why did you say that? You know what I mean?
But you stopped yourself.
Yes, And it was like, we hear these all the time, good girl, you know, good guy.
But all that is the control. Control.
Yeah,
Good girl.
The high five system. Everybody giving themselves a high five. You know, it's like, oh, good, you did it. Oh, good. Or, you know, or this constant praise that these kids are getting. It's like, I'm not so sure. That's based upon a judgment system that you're inflicting on everyone.
Well, and that it goes through school. It's good boy, good girl usually means.
Yeah.
Thanks for doing what I wanted you to do.
Correct.
And
correct.
And it's like a school system. It's who can remember what the teacher wants them to remember best? That's considered smart. A kid who can get an A and go through high school and get A's. Oh, I know exactly what the teacher wants me to, which is fine. That's a good skill in its own. But we don't need to say this person is smart. Well, there's a kid in the back of the room who's like, why? Are we sure this is right? And that kid is considered deviant and reckless, and they put ADD.
Yep.
Kids who are, if you ever see a free child, I don't see it often, but it's a beautiful thing where the kid is just themselves and they're embraced and they go have fun and they jump in puddles. But a lot of these kids, I mean, it's not natural to go to a school system. I mean, you're 5 or 6 years old, you go into school, and you're there for 8 hours a day, you're listening to a teacher, that's not natural. And so we have a kid who's creative and wants to go outside and play and starts questioning everything the teacher says. You know what most teachers will do? Not all teachers, but a lot of teachers will say, that kid's a problem. I think they got ADD. I think we got to give them medications. So again, we're taking somebody who's probably gifted and we're dumbing them down, but there's parents who allow their kids to be themselves, and it's not often enough, but I love watching it. They're just free, and we don't allow it. So we're teaching people, yes, you're good if you do what I say, like you said you did with your dog. But I catch myself doing it too. I'm like, good job, guys. But really, all that means is you're making my life easier, because you're taking away from my anxiety and you're taking away from my problems. I'm not really allowing you to be yourself.
I think
and we all do it.
I think I've been living the life of these past few years of less words, and sometimes you could just smile at somebody and that's
mm-hmm.
it, because then the words don't come out that would be the judgment base, you know? And
right.
It seems to be so easier. Well, Cortland, can you share with the listeners a little bit of your work? Because I want to go into next, I want to talk a little bit before we close, is about what do you do when you end up in a system and how can you work your way through that system to get the help you need? But also, too, how can you say, okay, this might not be the help I need? So I know your experience and the work that you do right now, you have a great insight into that.
I'm a registered nurse. I have been a patient in psychiatric hospitals, patient in drug treatment centers. I've been to jail all multiple times, you know, three or more.
Mm-hmm.
And then I ended up getting through it, going to school, and I've actually worked. Then I was a staff member, then I got my LPN, then I got my registered nurse, and I've been a staff, I've been an RN, I've been a supervisor. I actually even worked at some of the same facilities I was once a patient at, you know.
Right.
I think it's been over 24 years since
mm-hmm.
it started, and you know, then when I finally went through, you know, whatever it was, my last drinking binge, I started talking about it and I started writing about it. And then we came up with the website and the Facebook page, and it's just kind of happened. And then just wrote the book, and I still work in the field now. I mean, it's so I think the system, I think it can help, but it's not easy. It works against you. It does.
Yeah, and how do you think that people have come to getting help that may help them get through a good path? In other words, when you see that you need help, how do you recognize this is something I should do, going down that path and going that direction, or maybe I should find a different way?
If you think you need help, I guess I would ask what makes you think you need help, what's wrong.
Right.
Talking to people is a good start. Now, I generally think the system is corrupt and does a lot of bad things. But however, if it wasn't for a few people in the system, I wouldn't have made it. So there are good people in the system. It's just there's not enough of them. And the people that are good
right.
often are going against what the rules are, and they're either getting fired or they're getting burnt out or they're quitting.
Right. I've seen that, yeah.
And so I usually tell people, if you go see a therapist, give it three sessions, because
yeah.
if you don't connect with them as a person, that's fine, because some of us, I could go to a therapist and you could go to a therapist and you could think he's great and I could think he's awful. It depends on the relationship. If you
right.
connect, you find there's a million of them. So it doesn't, just because you go to one and it's bad doesn't mean they're all bad.
Right.
I think you can navigate your system, your way through the system like that. Like you said before, there's so much information out there. Somebody wants to prescribe you a med, look into it.
Yeah.
Ask questions. Don't just directly obey. And like I said about the doctor who spent an hour with me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I went to the same clinic months before that and was treated completely differently. Like he said, you have chronic fatigue syndrome. You have to go to a group. And I was like, what the heck are you talking about?
Yeah.
I need to go to a group. There is good people in the system, and there's a lot of information. Alternative medicine is huge, like acupuncture,
mm-hmm.
people who can do just there's alternatives that work.
I think doing research. I think, though, too, what you're also saying is that go and do whatever shows up for you, too. let's say if you end up in an AA meeting and you go there for 2 months, you know, and at the end you say, what the hell is this? This is crazy. You know, those are all people who are still drunk because they just came across the street from the bar. So then, you know, you find another one, or you could check yourself in for a while and you say, you know what, I'm going to do it as I'm checking myself in, so a self-check-in, and you have a certain amount of time and you could check yourself out. And it's all about the experience, don't you think? Because you would have never gotten to the place you are today if you didn't have all those experiences and were able to speak on it. In other words, if you had a roly-poly light time, you would say, oh, there's no problem with anything. See, ha, 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 I'm good. But you had challenges, and the challenges showed you something different each time, just like, you know, I've had in my life.
Right. Hard. Yeah. I've said that. I mean, I don't think, I guess sometimes I've learned this. I've said this to people in the moment, and it's really not that it's hard. But when you're going through these dark times, these people who are crying, and this is terrible. And I say this is beautiful, because this, all the times in my life that were the worst times and the times I was like, I can't take anymore, those are always the best lessons and the greatest things that have ever happened to me. You have to lose everything. You have to lose everything. And sometimes if you're not willing to give it up, you have to have it taken away from you by... And then you can start over again. And so a lot of times if I see people in a treatment center and they're like, everything's fine, everything's okay, I think, oh, no, they're not growing.
Here comes the train.
But if I hear somebody crying and slamming the phone, I'm like, oh, that's beautiful. It's happening. And so when somebody's going through that dark period, I'm glad everything that happened in my life happened, because you learn from it. And it certainly, when this stuff was happening, if somebody would have said that, I would have punched them in the face. But I said, you're crazy. But it's true.
And I think you and I being honest about this is exactly what people need to hear, because the honesty is what they're drugging down, don't you think?
Yes, it is. We don't want to talk about it. We don't want to have feelings. And I like what you said about the AA, because – what works for one person may not work for another, and one meeting is different from another.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like AA. I did some of them. I did some of them. I did, but some people it really works for them. So good. I mean, that's great. There's no one size fits all. I mean, I think you have to explore and educate yourself and research and what works for you. You see, I think we all create our own masks or false selves. We all create that based on how we were raised, our society, our environment growing up. So if our masks are all unique, all our mask removals need to be unique to us.
Absolutely.
So my recovery is going to be different from yours, because your mask is different than mine. You know, there's only one constant in all mask removals, and that's connection with other people. I mean, that takes away a lot.
I think a lot of people hold on to their mask until just before they die, if they have a time that they know. And I think when you hold that mask there, that's what's called regrets. It's what's called guilt and shame, and it's called fear. And I even know people who have tried through all different ways to try to keep themselves alive because of their fear to meet God, which is their ultimate, the ultimate end, in which they fear that God will see through that mask. God will, you know, you can't take it with you, your mask, and they are scared to death to die.
Right. And to be real for once.
Mm-hmm.
People are so afraid to be vulnerable and be themselves, because they've been hurt and they've been told since the time they were two that they're not okay. And everybody is, and we're living this lie, and people are making money off it. And humanity's suffering because we're not being ourselves. We're taught not to love ourselves. It's terrible.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, Cortland, we could talk for hours, but we've come to the end of this show. Maybe you'll come on again another time in maybe a month or so. We'd love to have you.
Sure, absolutely.
Well, Cortland, can you share with the listeners how to find out more information about your book and your website? That would be great.
My website is it's takingthemaskoff.com. Generally, we now write for what's called WakeUpWorld.com. We generally write for them now. We have a Facebook page that's Taking the Mask Off. And we wrote a book. It kind of goes through the time, starting when I was 18 and in the hospital through, you know, maybe a year ago or whatever, and about all the people I met and all the lessons I learned along the way. And it's on Amazon.com, and it's Barnes & Noble, and it's also at the Balboa Press website. And it's Taking the Mask Off, Destroying the Stigmatic Barriers of Mental Health and Addiction Using a Spiritual Solution. And I wrote it with Erwin Osborne, who is my partner and writes. He's my business partner, and he writes with me. We write articles together all the time. He's been through a lot of stuff himself, so we work together a lot on all of this.
And I think when you're able to finally get yourself through on the other side and you think you're, quote, alone, what you will find is people who have already been there and done that things, and you will find mm-hmm. that they are at a higher level of existence. And that's what you will end up being able to go forth. When you are coming through it, don't think you're going to have always the same relationships you did in the past, because those
you're not.
They don't work anymore. You simply can't go back to listening to whining or dependency or dysfunction. It's sort of like, my gosh, I can remember something as simple as someone said to me, I said to them, can you put the food away? And they're like, do you want me to put it in the refrigerator? And I'm like, say what? You know what I mean?
Well,
it was sort of like, why did you really even ask me that question? So when you get on the other side, simple things like that are going to be an indicator that you are on the other side and they're on that other side.
Yes. I've said that to people. If your relationships haven't changed, then you're not doing it.
Yeah.
Because I always say you're going to lose people. But that's okay. You're going to lose the right people. You're
that's
also going
right.
to gain new people who love the true self. And maybe some in every relationship's going to change, but maybe somebody who you thought was your best friend is not going to be as close. And then people who you thought you weren't close to, you become closer to. That all has to change. And if it's not, you're not doing it.
Right. And like I said, if you're talking and people start to say, I don't even know what you're saying, that's an indication inwardly that you are growing up. You are growing out of those relationships. So, you know, you won't get it abruptly all the time. Some will, but you will start to see those. Many times I've said something and people said, I have no clue what this woman's talking about. And you just say, okay, and, you know, and move on.
Well, yeah, and sometimes people want to, you start to change. You start to say different things. You start to be brave and be yourself. And a lot of people like you being that false persona. And so they will say whatever they can to push you to get your mask back on. They will say, you're sure are acting different. And, you know, just make little subtle comments or even be direct. And what they're trying to do is get you to be that false person again, because that benefits them. And they're afraid. They're afraid. People are afraid of somebody who's real and open and honest. It scares people. So people will try to push you back down.
It's what
that's
I call
a sign
the
to get
land,
away from them.
It's what I call the land of the digs when they start digging at you. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You say something and they're just like, they want to keep poking to get a reaction out of you, and you just don't have that same old reaction anymore. You know? So, Cortland, I think we've really come really far this time. And like I said, hope we're welcome back at another time for another show, because we could keep going on with this. This is wonderful.
We could. I could. I could talk about it forever. Thank you. It's been a good talk.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and it's been such a pleasure. Again, Cortland Pfeiffer, his book is Taking the Mask Off. Please do check it out. Do not be turned off about the size of the book. It's great because it is such a brisk read. You once you start, you say, oh, my gosh, I can see me here, or I can see someone else there, or maybe I'd like to try this, and I think it is the greatest book. It is definitely it has truth and honesty, and I think that's really what we need today. We don't need to hear, oh, just try this drug, you know, and all good, and you'll be able to go back to your old job. Who the heck wants to go to their back old job? I don't want to go my old back job anyway. If I'm speaking out, it's because I'm sick of that damn old job. So let's move on.
That's good. It's a sign of growth.
That's it. Well, Cortland, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Thank you.
Everyone, have a great day. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher with Wellness Radio. Until tomorrow, have a great night.
Today we discuss many life-changing concepts. Who do you turn to and how do you know what is best when faced with a health crisis? Dr. Jeanette is a patient advocate. She listens to the patient, the doctors, and the family, clarifies the health issues and concerns, then helps the patient make the best choices going forward. If you would like help implementing change into your life and health, we can talk and see where you are stuck and how to improve the quality of your life. Check the link on the bottom of today's show page or visit drjeanettegallagher.com to schedule a phone appointment today.